Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Raising Rebels family. This past December, Raising Rebels attended the People of Color Conference. This conference took place in Seattle, Washington, and it is basically a huge affinity group for people of color in independent schools all across United States, and I think people travel from all over the world really to attend this conference, where you get to really talk specifically about what it feels like to be a person of color in a predominantly white space. It's a powerful experience to be surrounded by all of these amazing educators that are thinking so much around how to free children. And I got the opportunity to have some of the most meaningful conversations with parents who were attending this conference. I want to suggest that you find a quiet space and you close your eyes and you put on some headphones as you listen to this episode, because it's really a time capsule. The stories that are told are so vivid, and also it takes place in this really crowded auditorium. And I would imagine, and I hope for most of us, we are not in very crowded auditoriums and probably won't be for a long time. And so I want to, you know, suggest that you take some time with yourself and enjoy this episode. I love you all. Stay safe. Be well. And please remember to find joy.
I'm Dawn, and I'm from Houston.
Yay!
Olivia Moorhead Slaughter from Milton, Massachusetts.
Tanita Fernandez from Pasadena, California.
My name is Jimmy Manyuru. I grew up in Kenya, and I live in the Boston area.
Tell us something about your kids.
So I have one child, Bailey, who's 2.5 years old, and makes me wild. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, we're in that fun stage right now, mm-hmm, of seeing this little person who can actually give you back responses and, mm-hmm, kind of tell you directives. So, mm-hmm, yeah.
My name is Lloyd Mitchell Duggar III. I am from Brentwood, New York, but I live currently in Southborough, Massachusetts.
Tell me why you say the third.
Because that's on my birth certificate. It's a badge of honor, because there aren't too many thirds. And the process by which I am the third is a bit unusual. It's my grandfather, it's his son, my uncle, and then me. So it's not in order. Mm-hmm. And I'm the only Lloyd in the family actually called Lloyd. The other two Lloyds don't go by Lloyd. So it's kind of like, all right, if you're going to give me the third, I'm going to say the whole name.
I love how we, black folks,
yeah,
just remix our shit.
So my name is Carla, and I'm from the Bay Area.
My name is Robin. I'm from Richmond, California.
My name is Oscar. I'm from New York.
Me too. We're in New York.
Lower East Side.
I grew up in the Bronx.
All right.
Yeah, we live in Brooklyn now. Huh?
I said, I forgive you.
Why are people in New York like this?
Nah, I'm just kidding.
No, it's so true. Every time we enter like your borough, your neighborhood, it's all right, because we already know.
I respect that.
I know. We already know.
Varghese Alexander from Asheville, North Carolina.
I'm Adrian, and I'm from Northern California.
Hi, Adrian.
Hi.
tell us something about your children.
So my daughter, my eldest, who turned 21 yesterday.
Ooh, oh, wow.
In New York City.
Yes. 21 in New York City. Yes. I was there.
Yes. So, she's amazing. She's, you know, she's ready to take on the world and get involved in everything. And she does a lot of spoken word. So I love that she communicates her thoughts, feelings on society and mm-hmm. how she's personally feeling through her poetry. It's mm-hmm. her therapy. So it's uncensored mm-hmm. by mommy, and mm-hmm. that's a way for her to release.
My name is Ashley Scott. I am from Atlanta, Georgia.
Russell Marsh from Newark, New Jersey.
Okay, my name is Sherry Spelitz, and I'm at home in Vienna, Austria.
Well, let's start with one word to describe how you're feeling right now.
Sometimes a little overwhelmed. But inspired.
Yeah.
I'm feeling excited.
Elated.
Yay!
Mm. I'm loving it.
Relaxed.
Right now, I'm feeling good. Mm-hmm. That's lame, but it's good. One word.
There's nothing lame about good. Tell us something about your children.
Oh, they're awesome. Oh, come on. An 8 and a 10-year-old. Real good phase. I work at a boarding school and they run the campus, right? But they don't really run the campus, but they're comfortable on campus.
Awesome.
And they don't care about the screens because they're walking around mm-hmm. in the woods and not in the woods mm-hmm. and riding bikes. Like, that doesn't happen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, one word. Energetic. Yeah. I got a lot of energy right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Tell us about your children.
My children. Okay. So I got two. Fun fact, so I'm about to have a grandchild too, which I don't know how I feel about that right now,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I ain't about 42.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
but my oldest son is 24. He's in the military. He just got married.
Mm-hmm.
His name is actually Dante Scott Jr. So he's a junior. And my youngest is 17 and he's an 11th grader. So he's getting ready to graduate next. He actually takes the ACT next year.
Okay.
I mean, next week.
Oh, wow.
So I'm excited for him and a little nervous too because, mm-hmm. you know, I want him to show out. So, you know.
Tell us one word to describe how you're feeling right now.
Surprised.
That's great. That's such a good. Well, I like the feeling of surprise. Do you like it?
I think so.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Tell us something about your children or child.
I have two children. I have one who is 25 and I have another one who is 12.
Mm-hmm.
So the 25-year-old lives in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And the 12-year-old is at home with me in Vienna.
That's great. Part of what we do in the podcast is we ask parents to do a recollection. And a recollection is like a memory, and we ask you to push back as far as you can. Because part of what happens when we're parenting is we think about it much of ourselves as adults, but we don't think enough about like who we were when we were children. And if we really hope to do it differently or to like push back against the oppressions that we like endured, you know, like our experience, we really need to unpack who we were. So I'm going to ask you to push back as far into your memory as you can. If you can, like, if you remember being 3, great. If you can't, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But as far back as you can and share a memory of a time you felt free. You felt free. And as much detail, context as possible, the better.
I remember, I think I was probably 5 or 6. My dad was abusive to my mom, and I'm the oldest, so I have more memories of my mom and dad together than my siblings do, and they don't have any good memories of them at all, of the memories they do have together. And the memory that I remember is my dad sitting in our living room, and I'm from South Georgia, so it's always hot, right? And he had on these shorts, and I was just looking at my dad, and he had these hairy legs, right? And I'm like, Dad, why, like, how your legs go hairy? And it was like, and to me, that was like, my dad's a man. Like, that's like he got all of his hair. Like, I always wanted hair on my legs because that symbolizes, like, manhood to me at that point. And I was like, I want to touch your hair. Like, I want to touch the hair because I want to know what it felt like. And my dad was like, all right, give me a quarter. You can touch my legs. And I was like, but Dad, he's like, nope, give me a quarter. So I ran through the house looking for a quarter. I'm turning over the cushions and the chair. I'm in my room. I'm under the bed looking for a quarter. And I came back with like a dime and a nickel. And he was like, I said a quarter. And I was like, well, I can't find no quarter. And so I just kept looking. And in the bathroom of all places, right, in the corner, it was a quarter. And I ran back and I gave him my quarter. And I just remember rubbing my dad's legs. And that's like probably the only memory that I really do have, the only good memory that I can remember of me and my dad. Yeah, after that, we played a game of chess. because my dad taught me how to play chess, and so that's the only memory I have. Yeah.
It's so interesting. Like, your freedom is so tied into, like, this feeling of, like, access to your dad's self. You know what I mean? His physical body.
I haven't talked about that in a long time.
It happens here on Raising Rebels. Don't feel away about it. That's what we do.
I was living in Queens, Jamaica Avenue, my brother and I, all right, my older brother. And oftentimes, we were either playing in our underwear or naked. And we had a pull-out bed. And I had a pull-out bed because my parents at the time were, you know, young black parents with two, soon to be three boys. And so we lived in a very small apartment, and my pull-out bed was underneath his. And I remember he had to pull it out. And I remember it ran over my toe. Like, ran over my toe. And I have so many memories of my pinky toe crashing into the metal part of this small-ass apartment and finding my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles under the bed, and like just that tiny small apartment in Queens. And I mean, we moved out when I was about seven, so I lived there since I was born until I was seven. But that's what I remember, is just that pull out bed going over my foot.
It sounds like freedom to me,
too. To be young.
Yeah, because it's like it's your own world, you know what I'm saying? And feeling like you have agency over that space, that's freedom.
I think back to a time when I was 5 years old, and I was in a kindergarten class, and a little boy threw a shoe, and it was a white teacher, and the teacher thought I threw the shoe, and she came and just snatched me up and dragged me into a cloak room. And I don't know if you remember back in the days they had those hooks, and she slammed my back against that hook. And that experience, and you know, so the principal came around and just started pointing his finger and yelling at me, why did I throw that shoe? And I was trying to explain, I didn't throw the shoe. And so it was very disheartening, of course, and very painful. And, but there was a black teacher that came through and said, this is one kid that would not have thrown that shoe. And I believe her. And then the truth came out of the kid that did throw the shoe, which was a little white boy. And nothing happened, but I felt free. I felt like this teacher rescued me. And from that point forward, she kind of took me under her wings. And they removed me from that teacher's classroom and actually put me into her classroom. So it was the first time I had a black teacher or some educator that really made a difference. And she just believed in me. And I think I felt free from that point forward.
Wow.
That's hard. That's a really hard one. So that whole free concept is kind of hard to unpack right now.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up on the Lower East Side back in the day. And so someone like me, when we say back in the day, this is before gentrification. I grew up in the projects. So I don't know how much freedom you can really have when you grow up in the projects on the Lower East Side. If I'm thinking back to like when I was really, really young, it's really hard. I'd walk to school by myself, around whatever kindergarten was, first grade.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about freedom. It didn't feel free, but I had space to be. So back in the day, for someone my age, there was no like internet, or like home wasn't really the place where you went to have fun. You went outside. So those memories are strong. I never knew that I came from an economically depressed neighborhood until I left it.
I know that so well. If you would have asked me, I'd be like, I'm middle class. I'm like, no, you not.
I had no clue what that meant.
No idea.
I was like, what? That didn't make any sense to me. Yeah, so when I was a kid, everything felt normal within that space.
When you were a child, you said, like, when you think about it now, you think, like, how can you have freedom in the, like, these oppressive, like, impoverished spaces? But when you were that first grader, home by yourself, you know, you're moving through the world by yourself, did you feel free?
I had freedom to be.
Yeah.
Right? I guess to think about freedom, I might want to think about when I didn't have it, right? So I had the opportunity to study at an independent school when I was in high school. I got sent away, and I didn't know what I was really getting into. I got sent to a school outside of Princeton, in New Jersey. Had no clue how far away that was from New York City. You have no perspective of what anything is outside of your borough. At that point is when I realized how this other group of people live. And I didn't feel at that point like I had the freedom to be me. Because I didn't have the freedom to wear my clothes, show my culture through my my being. And so I guess my first feelings of like feeling freedom as we're talking about it here must have been like one of those first times when I was at this independent school and I came back home, right? Because when I came back home, then I could wear what I wear, speak how I speak, and be me. So it really wasn't, you prompted me to think way, way back, but it was probably more around the age of 15, 16 that I understood what it meant. But even then in the neighborhood, you were kind of locked into certain paths home or into certain social groups based on the types of behaviors you wanted to avoid or be a part of.
I think I felt free my whole childhood. Mm-hmm. I think my whole childhood was one of freedom. Mm-hmm. Freedom in the physical sense of I could go anywhere. As a child, I could be sent to the store, to the corner shop to buy something. I come back home. There was no sense of unsafety or danger or anything like that. So I was free physically to run about, to roam about, to be with my siblings in the yard or on this, you know, on this mm-hmm. go out to the town or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. I think I've always felt free that way. Mm-hmm. I think I felt free to do whatever I wanted to do at home. Mm-hmm. I love to read. And even when my other siblings were doing chores and I was hiding away and reading, I felt like I was free to do that. Mm-hmm.
Felt free?
Yes. As early a memory as you can and with as much detail as you can.
Huh. That's a good question.
Thank you.
Yeah. So my earliest recollection, so I grew up in Kenya and for the most part, I was in the capital city. But before that, my dad worked at a small mining town called Magadi. And it was the kind of place where you talk about freeing, basically you could just, you know, at the end of the day or weekends, just you could just leave the house and just go off. Like, I mean, literally just walk. It was pretty much like a desert, but it would just, my siblings and I would just be gone for the day and come back at the end of the day. Just as long as you're there back before sunset. That was sort of my sense of things. I didn't think about that because that's what something I feel that you can actually do today. Like, I don't think if my child just went for the whole day, I would be like, a bit more leery. And I don't know why, but that's sort of...
Well, there are many moments, actually. I can think back probably around four or five years old and being up in the Sierra Nevada mountains. My dad worked on the railroad, so he would always take us up to the Sierras to be near the railroad tracks, and we would park the old station wagon, all the kids pile out and just go play in the dirt and the pine needles. And I remember very clearly the scent of the pine needles. It's almost a kind of a Christmassy but soapy smell, and what that felt like under my feet, and just running, sliding in the red dirt. And my younger brother and I just kind of digging in the dirt, making little holes here and there. And it was amazing. It's made me just remember the sound of the birds, because you don't hear birds as much as you used to. And what the sun looked like coming through the pine needles when we looked up. It was an amazing, amazing time. And my mom sitting by the car fixing sandwiches. My dad with my brothers out by the railroad tracks, him explaining something about how the engines did whatever they do as they moved through the mountains.
I was definitely a little girl, somewhere between 5 and 10, growing up in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, in a black middle class neighborhood, black everybody, but it was a beautiful black bubble. I could be outside all day long, in my neighborhood, on my bike, my friends' houses, just playing in the dirt, playing in the mud, just riding around, just doing the playing with our Barbie dolls, especially Julia, because she was black, playing with our black baby dolls, just playing with each other, eating fruit off of trees, popsicles. I was freed up, had no idea how freed up I was. And wishing I was grown.
Absolutely.
Mistake.
I'm thinking of being a kid maybe around 5 or 6 and visiting my godparents who lived in the country. I mean, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and my godparents lived in Chesterland, Ohio. And it was, you know, like we had to get on the freeway. And then we'd get off the freeway, go drive. It was a long drive to get out to their place. And then we would get on this kind of dirt road. And then we'd drive off to their long driveway. So I just remember being out there. And they had a huge yard. I mean, they had property, right? So they had the house, and then they had property that went on and on. And I just remember they had a small hill in the backyard. And I remember being a little kid and going up and down that hill. So going to the top, running to the top, and then rolling down again and again and again, giggling and just laughing and of course having lots of doting adults who were having a good time. And my godfather was, my Uncle Bill was cooking out on the grill and just enjoying all of that attention and that freedom.
Awesome. How does oppression show up in your parenting?
How does oppression show up in my parenting? I think it shows up in a kind of the anger that I feel when I have asked my child repeatedly to do something and the response is yeah in a sec, give me a minute, yeah, I'm almost yeah, here I come, and then finally I blow my top. and I say and the oppression is that it's that innate desire to need to control, and actually it's actually to have my authority acknowledged on point. Like I want it, like not now, not in 5 minutes, not, I want it. Okay. Hey, I said this, it's time for you to respond. So that I would say that pattern of oppression where the expectation is I am the authority and you will now act because I've said so. So it's a pattern of authority that is inherently oppressive.
How like amazing it is for your children to have a parent that recognizes that their need for authority is problematic. Do you know what I mean? Like, of course, like not of course, but yes, we are still pushing back and trying how to like not continue to practice it. But just the realization that there is another better way. There is another way. And that's not about how I have to relate to you as someone who's younger than me, who's someone who I birthed or not, or like in care of. Like, we don't have to relate to each other from this perspective of I am the authority. We can relate to each other in so many other different ways, and hopefully often do. And I'm gonna try and shift that. You know what I mean? I think that, you know, sometimes we don't, which is part of white supremacy, and like we only give ourselves credit for when we like get it, but not the journey to like getting to it. That might take a lifetime. And so congratulations on your journey.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure. It's interesting because I can give you that. It's a cognitive exercise, right? To tell you, oh, this is what I see and this is where it seems rooted. But I still want him to respond. And so it's thinking about that. But on the other side of that, what I do think is interesting is being able to have a conversation with him about oh, listen, hey, I'm sorry, I was really upset about that, but do you understand why?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, being able to have that conversation mm-hmm. has helped me
mm-hmm.
be less rigid.
Absolutely.
And less uptight.
When I'm when I'm in it with my partner, you know, something is almost constantly, not constant, but often doing things that irritate me or like that I would like to be done different. But with him, I'm always like, when I'm in my good space, when I'm feeling like in my like positive, I meditated, I ate well, I got time, I can recognize that it's about how I'm showing up to this conflict versus like what you've done to me. And I think that if we could have that same grace with our children and with ourselves around, like, it's not about necessarily what they're doing, but how I'm showing up to this conflict in this moment, and then I'm reacting. So I have the right to feel how I feel about your actions, for sure, but how I show up to that is all about me and all about, like, my shit. And I think that that's part of the healing. Like, that's what I'm saying when I'm saying the journey. Like, it's not, no, of course, you want, like, you know, things have to be done, and you know, like, I like the house clean. Like, I just do. It works for me. But it doesn't mean that it has to be like they're bad, I'm good. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I'm right, they're wrong. It can be so many other things. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, yeah, I'm crazy overprotective, right? I don't live in the neighborhood I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Part choice, part reality. The Lower East Side's super gentrified, crazy mm-hmm, expensive. Mm-hmm. No one can live there anymore. My family, my peoples can't live there anymore. So we moved out to like the suburbs. We went chasing the fake American dream.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as being oppressive, yeah, I'm overprotective with my son, or at least I was. He's 26 now. My daughter's 19, still overprotective. I have another daughter who's 7. And I just always try to protect them from the things I was trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sort of like that project life, the vices that are there, the traps.
Mm-hmm.
About a year ago in my independent school, I heard someone mention free range parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what? I didn't understand that. I mean, I understand it now, but I was just like, there's no way I could do free range parenting
mm-hmm.
only because I see myself as the guide for my kids. I see them as sort of like, this is what I went through. This is how I grew up. I don't want you to have to go through that yourself. So please follow my plan mm-hmm. as prescribed because I know best. And my kids don't get it. And so that feels oppressive.
I mean,
to
on
them.
Some level, you probably don't get it because it sounds like the way you were raised was free range parenting. Like right now, like the idea of letting your 6 and 7-year-old you know, take the elevator downstairs, walk to the corners, like all of that stuff that you did, play outside with your friend, like that's free range.
Yeah.
That's free range. And the way, and like, I think it's like, we're doing the best we know. Do you know what I mean? And like, the more we can unpack it, the wider what we know and can give act. Like I imagine like for your 7-year-old and your 26-year-old, right? That's what you said, the range.
Yeah.
And like what you have the capacity for has probably grown so much.
Yeah, look, I love my mother,
yeah.
but she should not have free range parent me. Like that was, you can't, we just got it. Because, all right, I'm fortunate enough to have my career right now to mm-hmm. be here at the POCC.
Mm-hmm.
Like in some ways, like my brother and I, we talk about this, you know, we are like this first generation economic success.
Mm-hmm.
But we both grew up with a lot of folks who just didn't make it out.
I know.
You know,
I know.
Locked up, dead,
yes,
whatever.
Yes, yes.
So they were free range parented as well, right?
Yes,
so it's sort
yes.
of like, I don't want to take that chance.
Yes.
Now, the question was, do I find myself being oppressive? Yeah. I working on being less? Absolutely.
Yes.
So yeah. trying to find this happy balance and this medium. I'm in between.
Think speaking to it. You know what I mean? Like speaking to the idea that it's not necessarily about who you want to be as a parent, but like this larger white supremacy that creates these environments that are not safe, that don't feel safe, right? And just knowing like we're scared. Do you know what I mean? And like how often you get to tell your kids like, not just like, I want you to do A, B, or C because I know the way, but I want you to do A, B, and C because I'm so scared because I've seen, you know what I mean? Yeah. And how it could still be hard, you know what I mean? It could still like, I still want to go out and I still want to do this, but this understanding that it's coming from a place of like real intimate like feeling versus what white supremacy does is like, that's just the way it is. That's not just the way it is. That's the way we're trying to figure it out. Thank you.
I know that I prepare my sons. I have two sons, 25 and 29. And I probably have prepped them for all kinds of things that could happen, that might happen, because I'm protecting them from what I know is there to greet them and from the things I don't want to happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one way it's showing up still in my parenting. I don't wear gold. I wear silver for obvious reasons.
You can't see at home, but she has the most beautiful high top. It's amazing.
So I wear silver. So, but in my jewelry box, I actually have some gold chains. My hair wasn't always this color. So I have some gold chains. I got some bracelets, whatever. And definitely one of my sons would like to have one of the chains that he could wear around his neck. And I won't give it to him. I don't want him to wear it because I think it'll make him a target. It will make him vulnerable, unsafe. So they're sitting there. I guess I should have them melted down. I don't know at what age he would be. It would be okay for me to say, here, honey, wear these. It's not a problem because definitely they're could be worn by a man or a woman. But they're sitting there.
I want to say that sometimes it's like the not doing it becomes what we focus on, but the liberation can come from just talking about the why. So to bring attention to like, I want this for you.
Yes.
It's not about who you are. It's not about the jewelry. It's just about this big, horrible thing that is sitting over both of us and it keeps us from this.
Yep.
And how liberating, how much freedom you both would have to talk about the oppression that you share, and that can be like, that can grow the freedom, right?
And I recently, you know, had this conversation with my husband because just a week or two ago, and my friend here might recall this, there was an incident in the Boston area, really early morning, 12:30, 1:30 in the morning. A young black man or young man was attacked. And what they wanted was the chain from his neck. And he's dead. And I said to my husband, and this is why they stay in the jewelry box, because
say it to your son. Say it to your son. Yeah, just say it. Just
and
say
I haven't said it to him.
Yeah, say it to your son.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for doing the podcast.
Yay! How does oppression show up in your parenting?
It shows up in my thoughts. It shows up when I start parenting from a fearful place. But I have to stop myself from doing that. I have to look at my boy of where he is now and not think about, be scared for what he could be. So I want him to have that rebellious spirit, but I don't want that to harm him. So I have to make sure that I stay in the moment and recognize him as a 7-year-old and not the 12-year-old that I think he's going to be and that the world can see. So that's how it shows up. It shows up from a place of fear. And I think parents sometimes, in order to protect them, they cover them in that fear, especially as a black boy. And he's already 4'3". So he's at least going to be my height. I don't know what his build is going to be, but he's going to at least be my height. So I'm 5'10". So he's going to be at least 5'10", maybe 6 feet. That's scary. So if I'm operating from a place of fear, my fear wants to get that out of him.
Mm-hmm.
But my love wants to keep that. And you can't do both. Well, I can't do both.
We have to, like, I think we just have to, first of all, be compassionate with ourselves as parents. Right. And we have to, like, keep evolving, right? Like,
right.
keep doing what we, like, know we can do and pushing. Like, just keep pushing ourselves. As you were talking, I was thinking, like, Disney is so fucking problematic. And the reason I say that is, as you were talking, it kept making me think about that line in Finding Nemo when Dory is like, well, he can't, Marlin is all upset and worried because Nemo, he's like, I want him to be safe. I don't want, and Dory's like, well, you can't, if he doesn't do anything, he won't do anything. But Disney should have made those voices be black people's voices. I think that if there were black voices instead of like Ellen or whoever the fuck else, voice, we would like, it would be more authentic and more accurate. And I'm not saying that white folks don't also feel oppression or have fears for their children, but that understanding and like how many black us, right? Because when we would have, like, Nemo came out, I was like a teen, like I'm, you know, your age, like I mm-hmm. was a teenager, but still, like, if you got to watch Nemo,
right,
you get to have that healing process as a black father who's scared for his son, mm-hmm. who is just being a kid, goes out in the world, gets right. caught up.
Right.
Father goes and gets him.
Right.
Nemo gets to know and heal around, like, I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to learn from it.
Right.
But my people going to come get me, so I'm good.
But at what cost, though?
Well,
So Nemo wouldn't pay the same cost.
But this is the thing. This is the thing. This is the thing. We're all here.
Right.
You're right here right now.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I'm right here right now. So I'm not saying that bad shit don't happen. Of course it does. Like, they are coming for us. Like, no doubt about it.
Right.
But if we don't also elevate and like, give voice to our stories of, like, being whole, right. you know, like, to the, if we give, you know, like, the ones that does, like, the parts that don't work out get a lot of, we give it a lot of voice. And the parts of, like, and I'm not talking about success from, like, a white supremacist, you financial success, you got this, but success of, like, you are loving
right.
your boy.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
wow, you're loving your boy every day. And I think that as much as those, like, just as you said, like, as much as that fear is real, I think just being able to have that conversation and thoughts around like that, it is fear. It's not just the way it has to be. It is based on.
But do we have those conversations to recognize that it's coming from fear?
No, what I mean.
Do we redo it and redo those old jokes?
Absolutely.
Like, I'm going to beat you so the cops don't beat you. Like, I was told that.
Yes.
But my wife and I made a decision. It's like, we're going to take the best of our parents.
Yeah.
So that worked in the 80s, right?
Because
I grew up in the 80s. Crack and
yes.
like it was. I grew up in Newark, so like I'm the poster child for that.
Mm-hmm.
But those old tools don't work.
Yeah.
So are people having that conversation and highlighting the good stuff, like taking the best of those what work and leaving the stuff behind? You know what
and
I mean?
And I think if you look at it from the perspective of collective liberation, we have to ask ourselves the question of, did it work? Because if we're thinking about like one, some, many, but we're not thinking about all. We know as much as we tried, as much as our parents tried, it didn't work, right? Like it did a thing. It allowed for some. It allowed for us sitting here right now. But work, you know, like, and I think just having those conversations, just continuing to unpack it is like what we're hoping to do. Thank you.
But just keep passing it on, though.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Russell, you did the thing.
Thank you.
I'm sure it shows up all over the place. Because the number one thing I think about is what my ancestors struggled through.
Mm-hmm.
And I guilt trip my kids,
mm-hmm.
I'll admit it, my boys and my daughters. And I'm like, you know what your grandparents went through?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you like owe it to them. You really do. Because part of it, I know I can't even imagine what both sides of my family went through. I heard stories, but it was pretty bad. So when opportunity comes or when you have the chance to seize it, you go for it.
Mm-hmm.
You practice what you're passionate about in life. But if I'm going to let you practice your passion,
mm-hmm.
you have to go at it full force.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just try it and decide in a week it's gotten hard and you're going to quit it. Mm-hmm. I always have a contract with my kids. If you want to become a, what was it? My eldest wanted to be a harpist. She wanted to play harp. I made her bug me for 6 months. And then when we were ready to get her a harp, I made her sign a contract.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, seriously.
No, I believe you.
You'll be playing this for this long.
I believe
this
you.
This is your practicing, mm-hmm. and you cannot budge.
Mm-hmm.
Even
mm-hmm.
though, I mean, it's hard mm-hmm. for us as parents to, mm-hmm. you know, take kids to lessons, play for lessons, you know, pay for them, and then monitor and make sure they're practicing for that allocated mm-hmm. amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's a give and take.
I wonder how it would feel for them around, because it's interesting, I similar, right? Like I have three girls and they have interests and things mm-hmm. that they want to do, and their level of like commitment to it is that of a 9-year-old, is that of an 11-year-old, is that of a wherever they are in that time and space. And that idea that you get to like try something and then decide to quit it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but lots of the problem is I see examples of people quitting it too often.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a privilege, mm-hmm. I believe,
yes.
to get the opportunity to do something like that. And I also believe they should be exposed to a lot before they make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, oh, I just saw this and I want it. I want you to be exposed to a variety of things, whether it's sports or musical instruments or technology devices. I want you to think out of the box mm-hmm. and have time to think out of the box. So you're not, because I'm not a big believer on overscheduling mm-hmm. kids, because you can't find their passion mm-hmm. if they're overscheduled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But once you make that decision, it needs to be for a substantial amount of time.
Yes. And the idea that it is a privilege, right?
Yeah.
Like to be able to take advantage of all of these opportunities that mm-hmm. you speak so well to, mm-hmm. that you are so aware of, was denied your ancestors. And so probably denied us. You know, like every time yeah. we push it forward more and we're mm-hmm. trying to like give more access to our people. And I often just think about like what a privilege it also is to be able to quit. And like from our perspective as oppressed parents, quitting is like you can't get to where you need to go if you're going to give up something so quickly mm-hmm. and not give it its all. But then you see so many other people like that all the other side of like if it's not working for you, how do you move past it? And that is the conundrum that we like, it's just such a trap. Like it's like we're in a constant trap around you do it this way, it's oppressive. But wait a minute. If you do it this way, it's oppressive too, or it has elements of it, and like just giving ourselves the grace around we're doing the best we know how. Do you know what I mean? And when we know more, we do more, mm-hmm. and that we love them and that mm-hmm. we share with them and that we're honest with them of like what, like something with my parents is like, you didn't hear why, you know, like what the, you know, like What were you thinking?
You didn't even want to say why,
yeah,
because
yeah,
if you
yeah.
said why, that it was over.
Yeah, you didn't like, it was just, this is what it is.
Yeah.
And how powerful, I think, even sometimes more than the actual experience of what your parent is like telling you to do, or mm-hmm. like whatever those structures, whatever that is that you think is important for young people to have an understanding of like, but this is how I got to that. You know what I mean? This is mm-hmm. what's underneath how I'm talking to you about it. I think it's so powerful and something that we can do to help to continue like dismantle this oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for talking with
yeah,
us.
Thank you.
I mean, you wonder about what you hold back, right? Like when you're holding back from the kids, and then you got to question yourself when you're holding back. Immigrant family, mm-hmm. right? We immigrated when I was 2. So traditional immigrant family, they want to do better by us. And we've got all of those things wrapped around it, meaning like discipline and all of that. And so I guess this goes both ways. So discipline, I'm like, all right, I get it. Capital punishment, not good. Not good. Too many power dynamics in capital. So, but then I go, I want to make my kid feel uncomfortable when they're doing something wrong. So I go to the water gun, right? I literally have a water gun. Yeah, we'll get real, right? I have a water gun, and then I shoot them with the water gun. And then these other parents are like, what do you do? You treat them like cats. I'm like, I'm not treating them like, wait a second. What would you say my parents treated me like if they were beating me, right? Like, I go right there. And I'm not saying that, whatever, you do your own, but I wanted to make the peel off girl take a step back. When they were little, and this is going to seem negligent, I used to put them on top of the fridge. Again, 6'7", you got to utilize the height. Timeout has to be somewhere where they're not comfortable and they need to calm down. And as scary as it is, and I was around, right? Like, it wasn't like I left them on the fridge and left for half an hour, but they knew that they had to calm down on top of there. Right, if they didn't calm down, they're not coming off the fridge. And as soon as they calmed down, they were coming off. So it was a sort of.
It's so interesting when you say we have one of the episodes that we did on Raising Rebels is about what is it called? I Brought You Into This World. So it's about discipline, and the whole conversation that we have. Like I talk about, my parents use capital, but like we got beaten. I'm immigrant too, first generation Jamaican, and there's this idea of like, so when I had kids, it's like same thing, like. Capital to punishments? No, we don't do that.
Corporal, you're right. My bad. Good catch.
Thank you. Fact check. Thank you. Corporal.
You're right.
Punishment. And we didn't even use that word. Just got your ass beat. So yes, we, exactly. Like whatever
that's
the case.
We don't even know the word.
We don't even know the word because we didn't use that. It was the same shit. Anyway, so I was like, I don't do that. I was never gonna do that. But that fear. I utilize that shit all the time. And like, I don't realize like where is it the same? You know what I'm saying? Like it's really easy to look at where it's different, but what's really hard is to look at the places where it's the same and why. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Absolutely. I will say they get to shoot me if I yell, right? The idea is I make them uncomfortable, but it's so that I can't yell at them. I don't want to yell at them. That emotional piece. So then they get to throw.
We're all doing. I mean, that's the thing.
We got to find our own way to do it.
And just keep investigating. It's not about like we figured out. Obviously, none of us has figured this shit out. But just being willing to like check our, like just think about it. Let's be open that there might be another way.
I never gave birth to children. But I have five children. Mm-hmm. I adopted. One was my great niece, another was my four great great nephews, and of course came from dysfunctional environments, and that's why I took them in, and just trying to watch them navigate their ways through life and through a society that, especially not in favor of African-American boys, it's kind of been a struggle. And I feel like the system fights against our children, especially our black boys. And so constantly trying to just reaffirm them and make them feel valued and give them opportunities that they could never have otherwise. We give them an education, because there's two pipelines, I feel. One to prison, one to the education system.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a constant struggle, and it's a constant fight. Fighting for needs that they may have, for IEPs, mm-hmm, for services, mm-hmm, for counseling, mm-hmm, for everything mm-hmm. that they need, is a constant struggle.
It sounds like you're doing for your children what was done for you. You're rescuing them.
Absolutely.
And by doing that, allowing them freedom.
Yes.
So you're like, you're standing up. Like, you're the one who is like going and talking to all of the larger society about what they need.
Absolutely.
So that they can be free.
Yes.
What a gift.
Yes.
What a gift.
And to be able to free them and let them know that there are people that care about
absolutely.
Them. And that people want to see them succeed and to be successful.
Yes.
In life. And so giving them opportunities and chances.
Yeah.
And believing in them.
Absolutely. Because you were believed in.
Because I was believed in.
Yes. Thank you so much. How does oppression show up in your parenting?
I tell you how it doesn't show up, right? I tell you how it showed up before, right? Because one thing that I tell a lot of friends of mine who are parents mm-hmm. that I learned after my oldest got too old for me to apply this
mm-hmm.
is to always listen. Mm. And so with my youngest son, no matter what he wants to talk about, no matter how long my day has been, like I'm telling you, the boy can go on and on about freaking anime and YouTube. And I'm like, oh, for real? Like, what this character do again? Like, what's his name? And we're going on. And I'm like, I really don't want to be there. I'm telling you the truth. But I want him to be able to come to me about anything, right? And then so I think what how it showed up in my parent and my parenting previously, right, was just not being completely present. And the idea of parenting was the bills are paid, the food is on the table, we're gonna have a couple of laughs, right? But now I got to get to this thing right here, right? And so I wasn't able to fully practice what I was, what I have been preaching to other people with my first son. But now he's older. Like now we're able to talk so freely. Like he calls me about the silliest things. Dad, what happens when you jump your car off and it don't come? Like, and what if I put the red one on the black one? And what's gonna happen? And it's like, it's gonna be all right. Like red on red, black on black, you're gonna be fine, right? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Dad, he texts me, Dad, what do you do when you lock your keys in your car? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it made me, you know, it makes me feel good because he's calling about trivial stuff, but who else is he gonna call?
That's right.
You know what I'm saying?
That's
so
right.
I would say, like, for me in my history, it has just been the absence of myself.
Yeah.
You know, particularly my oldest.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Yeah.
That was powerful.
Thank you.
That's a good question. My goodness, I hadn't really thought of that. Probably by, in my personal parenting, oh my goodness, probably in how I would teach my daughters how to present themselves or not present themselves in either one, you know, depending on how you want to look at it. Making sure that they're seen but not overly seen, if that makes any sense at all, which it doesn't in this
moment. It makes sense in oppression. You know, yeah, it makes sense in a world that is focused on minimizing, on harming our children, right? It makes sense. It totally makes sense. And thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Awesome. So tell us your name and where you're from.
Regina Buckley. I'm from San Diego, California.
What's one word to describe how you're feeling right now?
A little scared.
Tell us about your children.
I have one daughter. She's 14, going on 15 in May. So she's in 10th grade. She's a little young for her age. She's actually a year ahead of where she should be. She goes to an independent private school in San Diego.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So part of what we do on the podcast is we ask parents to do recollections. And basically a recollection is like a memory. And we ask parents to do a recollection as far back into their memory as they can, because often when we think about our parents and we think about like where we are now, but actually it's so important to think about who we were as children, because that's really informing so much of how we engage with our children. So I'm gonna ask you to push back as far as you can. If you can remember being four, the better, but like however far back you can go, and to think of a recollection of a time you felt free. And if you can give us as much context for that recollection, where you were, how old you were, what was happening for you, anything like that is helpful.
Well, I guess I'd have to go back to, I think of my childhood as a dichotomy. I was born in Georgia, and we moved when I was 3 going on 4 to Connecticut. My parents moved north, so my brother and I, he wasn't born yet. I'm 5 years older than my brother, but they wanted us to have a better education than where we came from in Georgia. I was born in a very small town, about an hour outside of Atlanta, and that's where my mom grew up. Her mother grew up there. Her, you know, all my ancestors pretty much come from that area, and my father as well. And he is the only one in his family who got a college education. My mom did not have a college education, so they wanted my brother and I to have good education. So they moved to Connecticut. But I still remember living in Georgia as a young child. When I was in Georgia, I was around my relatives. Both my mom and my dad had multiple brothers and sisters. My mom had 11 brothers and sisters, I think, and my dad had 9. And they just doted on me. And that was my world, and I didn't know anything else at that time. I didn't know even there were people that didn't look like me that would necessarily treat me badly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember walking to probably, this is my earliest memory, is my grandfather walking me to, it must have just been, you know, corner store in a one horse town, but to get me a pop, what we called a soda, it was orange soda. He called it pop. And he would do that, and I would spend time with him, and I just felt very secure and safe and I guess free. That I could do whatever I felt like and it would be okay.
Mm-hmm. How does oppression show up in your parenting?
So I think I carry a lot of, so like I mentioned, when we moved, my world became very different. We moved from that environment to a town in Connecticut that was predominantly white, and all of a sudden I became other. And I didn't realize I was other at first. It's sort of, you know, a lot of little things started happening where, you know, and then you start being around kids who have no problem telling you you're other. And so that hurts when you're a small child. Mm-hmm. And
it hurts when you're a grown up.
And it hurts when you're a grown up. But when you're a child, you don't understand why it's happening. You think it's you. You think there's something physically wrong with you. That, you know, other kids don't want to play with you or make fun of how you look.
Mm-hmm.
So you internalize it. And I wouldn't necessarily even tell my parents about all of it, because when you're that young, you really think it's has something to do with you. And then even when I found out it wasn't me, because my parents, you know, would begin to tell me things. They told me things from a very young age about, you know, because they grew up during Jim Crow and they didn't want me to go through the same kind of hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So they would, you know, say things like, you really should not make many white friends because you can't really trust them and things like that. And that just puts you on guard. So I think in terms of my parenting, I still carry some of those hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I will never forget ever. We'd done a short stint in upstate New York. My dad had gotten transferred. And we moved to a town outside of Buffalo. And we lived in a duplex. And this family had moved next door to us, a family of three kids. One of them was a couple years younger than me. And I'd seen her, this little girl with red hair. Her name was Michelle. And I wanted to meet her, but I never got a chance to meet her. So one day, one of the kids that I played with on the street said, oh, I'll take Michelle's down at the, we had a park down at the end of our street. I'll take you down there and introduce you. So I was on my bike. I still remember this. And I rode down there. And she went and got her from the slide and brought her over. And I thought I was going to meet her, but the little girl came over and said, I'm sorry, Regina, Michelle's parents said she can't play with any black kids. And I just will never forget that hurt. And then it was just so normal for her. And she was just like, but we'll see you later. And she just went off with Michelle and went to play. Like, and I'm just left standing there by myself. And I literally remember just looking at the ground the whole time going back home by myself, just feeling, I don't even know how to explain it. But, you know, that stuff that, you know, you have inside and you tamp it down so you can't feel it. But then when something happens in your child's life that triggers it, that feeling, you can overreact to a situation or if it's, you know, the similar situation that happened to you. Like the first time, you know, I felt like Maya was experiencing discrimination. That's my daughter. I just said her name.
There's a zillion of them.
First time she experienced it, I was surprised at how visceral I couldn't even control my emotions. You know, I couldn't step out of the situation. I felt it from my toes all the way up to my, and just thinking, you know, kind of what is happening to me? Why I've been taken all the way back to that moment. That's what's happening. I feel the same way. Like I want to cry and I want to kill someone.
I think that we don't look at those experiences enough as trauma. And so what happens with people who've experienced trauma, right? They figure out how to cope. or they suppress it, or they overreact, or they find drugs, like all kinds of ways. And the way that you heal trauma is by looking at it, right? And telling the story of what happened to you, recognizing the spaces where you had control and spaces where you didn't have control, recognizing that trauma happens to you, like, right? There's nothing that you can do to either create or prevent. And so when you gotta do all of that work. And so when you are parenting with your child, like you say, the hard part about it is, like, your child's going to experience her own traumas.
Yes.
And there is nothing that you can do to either protect or prevent, because it's not about you. It's about white supremacy. And I think that the illusion and the extra burden that we have to hold as oppressed parents is this fantasy that there's a wrong or right way to help protect our children from white supremacy. Whether it's to, like, your parents, like, oh, I want you to have a better opportunity, so I'm gonna go up north,
right,
so you can have this education, or all of the numerous ways, like, I don't want to put my trauma on you, so I'm gonna protect you from my stories,
right,
and constantly wrestle with, no, you're gonna do your own thing, it's gonna be better for you. No,
right.
You know it's not.
And that's the hardest thing, though.
Yeah.
I think is realizing that we live in a society where we don't have 100% ability to protect our kids. And there's shame that comes with that, too.
Yes. But I think that the bigger thing, this is the thing, this is the stuff that drives you crazy. Why should we live in a world where we have to protect our children?
Exactly.
You just described so beautifully that you felt the most free in your childhood, where your parents weren't worrying about protecting you because
right.
you were surrounded by your people.
Right.
And for most of human history, we've all been surrounded by our people. And what is fucked up about America is that they have determined from its birth, from its inception, that some people are our people and other people are not our people. And so now you as a parent in 2019, you know, to have to, like, your main focus, so many parents' main focus is protecting our children. Like, that's normal. That's what we should be worried about. That's everything we do should be around. No. We should be being with our children. We should be experiencing them.
Yeah.
We should be guiding them. We should be loving them. We should be playing with them, laughing with them, like, living life. Yay, yay. You can't be worried about protecting somebody and then allow them freedom.
Yeah.
So, right? How does that work? How does that work?
It sort of doesn't.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
And I think, like, what gives me hope in it, recognizing it, is, like, okay, now I get to, like, do something completely different. You know, like, now I can, like, finally just strip away the illusions that I can, like, make it something it's not. Now we get to just do a thing, right? Now we just get to be together and, like, love each other and do the best we can do, which I think is the gift of, like, excavating the trauma.
Exercising.
Like, when you try to, like, dig it up.
Right.
You know what I mean? Look at it. Dig it up and look at it. And so I wish that for you. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me.
Absolutely.
That's great.
Thanks. Whew. I know. That was a thing. That was a thing. I've listened to these conversations over and over again, and I just keep learning something new every time I listen back. So I suggest you also listen back. Right now, there's a part of this movement that is being held by young people, in which they've started IG pages titled Black At and the name of their school, where students and some educators are just sharing stories about what it feels like and things that have happened to them at predominantly white institutions. I want to suggest that you look them up. The stories are so incredibly moving, and really speaks a lot to the things that were discussed in this episode by these amazing educators. Please stay connected. We're on IG and Facebook and Twitter and all the places. We'll be back very, very soon with new episodes of Raising Rebels Season 3. Hoo-cha! Okay, be well. Instead of
fussing and fighting. This podcast was produced by Domino
Why
Sound.
Why not get together and live in one love and one identity, you know? Rebel in the morning, rebel in the evening too. would you be like my devil when I plead with sounds going to rebel, rebel, rebel.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com. Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.